I want to welcome everybody to this week's Saturday LaRouche Pack class. I'm Susan Kokinda. I'll be hosting tonight. I'm replacing Keisha Rogers, who was supposed to host, but thanks to the vagaries of the Texas power grid, she's unable to do so. And as we'll hear from Ben tonight, that could become a permanent fixture if we allow our enemies to succeed with their upcoming plans. Ben Denniston with the LaRouche Pack Science team is going to be giving the major presentation tonight. And the focus of this is indeed what the intentions of the global elite are as they escalate their drive to eviscerate what's left of the physical economy of nations. As many of you may know, a week from tomorrow on Halloween, the COP26 climate change summit is going to be convening in Scotland. We're affectionately calling this Ghouls Gathering in Glasgow because that's precisely what it is. And in honor of the fact that it is Halloween next week, I do want to share a very frightening picture with you. And that is one of those ghouls, namely Prince Charles, in addressing a pre-meeting to the COP26 summit, addressing people in Saudi Arabia. He warned again that we have a dangerously narrow window to tackle global warming. As Ben may mention later in the presentation, Prince Charles is fairly famous for announcing that the world is going to end next week or next month, and he's been doing so for about the past 20 years. But I think as a necessary antidote to the insanity, the pessimism, and the pure evil of what will be convening in Glasgow next week, let's hope that the current schedule holds and the third SpaceX mission is due to blast off and take astronauts to the International Space Station on October 31st. The Glasgow summit, the COP26 summit, is taking place against the backdrop of the death throes of the globalist system, a system in which increasingly over the past 30, 40, 50 years, everything exists to serve their empire of money, whether it is governments, whether it is physical economies, whether it is people, their only purpose from the standpoint of the global elite is to feed their parasitical system. And I think that's going to become even more clear coming out of the Glasgow summit, because even though there's tremendous resistance from many nations, Xi Jinping of China is not going. And China has recently reopened some of its coal mines because they were suffering blackouts and brownouts because of these insane carbon restrictions. Vladimir Putin of Russia will not be attending. Of course, our hapless avatar, Joe Biden, will be attending, but he's going to be attending without having been able to pass large parts of his so-called Green New Deal policy, the $3.5 trillion so-called infrastructure bill, which is running into tremendous opposition, including, as I think everyone knows, from people in his own party, like Joe Manchin, who does represent the coal state of West Virginia. But the way the elites, I think, have stated they intend to escalate is simply ignore governments. And one of the things they hope to intensify coming out of the COP26 summit is the role of the private central banks and private financial institutions in increasingly dictating policy by simply controlling the issuance of credit and determining where people can invest and where people can't invest. And that underscores the importance of the fight that we've been waging at LaRouche Pack and the current initiative, which we have launched, which is called a resolution to re-Americanize the U.S. economy. Because the question of what entity should have primacy in terms of economy, the question of whether it is the Goulds gathering in Glasgow, private financier interests, or whether it is sovereign nations, is at the core of our resolution. And I want to once again share the screen and point out two things on our website, especially for those viewers who may be joining us for the first time or may be discovering us on YouTube. Here is our resolution to re-Americanize the U.S. economy, which states in a very straightforward way, the system of globalization has failed, the entire system. It has to be replaced, and it has to be replaced by the American system. And just yesterday, we posted a really excellent backdrop article for that by Mike Carr entitled, "Will We Now Rescue the U.S. Economy by Americanizing It?" And Mike goes through some really wonderful examples of what the American system actually is. Some of the figures that have embodied it in terms of the spirit of constant innovation, constantly pushing the frontiers of technology or industry, and so on. And that, in short, is the essence of the difference between this imperial system, and Ben is going to be discussing, in particular, one of the most evil manifestations of it, which is the Malthusian idea of limits to growth, versus the American, the Renaissance, and indeed the human idea of constantly pushing the frontiers, constantly innovating, constantly developing, which is why we want people to take that resolution and launch this discussion of a fight for a return to the American system as the only real replacement for the evils of this globalist green insanity that we're facing right now. So with that, I want to turn it over to Ben.
Thanks, Susan. Glad to be on with everybody again. Sounds like a pretty frightening Halloween coming up at this conference. So we're going to do a couple discussions, one this week, one next week, on the climate issue, the climate change, the COP conference, all this whole process going on here. Today, what we're going to do is situate this current conference and this current push to get more motion on this climate change agenda, and we'll define what that is a little bit more. I'm going to situate that in a much larger historical context. I want to look at that from the standpoint of a broader historical process of the fight against empire and oligarchism. So I'm going to jump over and get my slides going here. So we're going to talk about the Malthusian origins of the man-made climate change scare. That's our discussion tonight. Just since we're on the issue of climate, just to kind of maybe put some context on the climate issue directly, just want to go through a couple of things, you know, just state outright from my view, from everything I've looked at, what I believe are the truths and the lies around the climate issue, just to kind of situate the discussion a little bit, put a little bit of rigor and analysis to what you're hearing. One, you know, the greenhouse effect is real. It exists, right? It's a lot of what we hear discussed, the greenhouse effect and our contribution to it. Yes, I think it's true that humans are contributing to the greenhouse effect. Just saying that doesn't tell you how much, if it's problematic or not. But that's a reality. That's part of the situation we're dealing with. And yes, the climate has been changing, right? If you look at the process over the last century, you go back farther, there's variations and changes in how the climate operates. Those are valid, truthful points. The problem is there's not an honest scientific discussion about going from these realities to the claims and assertions being made. So these are some of the assertions we're hearing. We're now causing a crisis. Well, there's no evidence of that. The recent climate change that we've seen cannot be natural, must be purely attributed to our activity. That hasn't been proven. That's been modeled. There's been models that claim that. But the claim that the climate change that has occurred and the climate change that will continue to occur is caused by us has not been proven. That's not a scientific conclusion. That's an assertion. That's a claim. That's propaganda that's being pushed on behalf of this agenda. And the big assertion on top of all of this, what they lead with most of the time, is the policy they're insisting happens in response to these assertions, built on some facts deeply underlying all of that, which is that we must go to a zero carbon economy, replace all fossil fuels with renewables like wind and solar. That's what we're hearing. That's what's being shoved down the throat of people. There's a whole spectrum of assessment, analysis, judgment, decision in that process that you're just being told has all been decided upon, right? Even if some of these earlier assertions had some truth to them, which I don't believe, the claim to leap that we need to go to eliminating all fossil fuels and that we need to primarily go with wind and solar as our energy sources is a complete assertion being imposed. They're just claiming that has to be the response to this situation. It's completely ridiculous, right? So that's, just to put the climate issue in a little bit of context. And if people have questions on some of these issues of climate change, what causes climate change, what contribution are we having, if any, we can take that up a little bit more in the Q&A. But when you get to this point of this insistence on wind and solar and so-called renewables, people have to realize, and this is a chart I've used, people might be familiar with this, and we've discussed this in a number of classes. If people are new, this might be new to you, but what we're seeing is that wind and solar are the most expensive and the least reliable sources of electricity of all the major options available. And here you see this depicted very clearly in a scatter plot of nations in Europe. And if you simply compare the relation between the amount of wind and solar they have installed and the cost of their electricity prices, it's very clear there's a direct relation there. The more nations push to subsidize and force implement large amounts of wind and solar, the higher their electricity prices, the higher their costs go up. And this is nowhere near what it would be if you actually tried to have a full zero carbon electricity or zero carbon energy sector across the board. and there are reasons for this, which we can again get into in the Q&A, and we cover this in other places, but wind and solar are inherently low energy flux density sources of power, very inefficient, and not, it'd be impossible to maintain the modern global economy, let alone the amount of growth and development that's required on a primarily wind and solar based economy. And you already see that in the evidence of places that have tried to implement wind and solar. Another example in the United States, California. Again, I've shown this before. Electricity prices over the past decade in California compared to the rest of the country have risen at a rate 7 times higher than the rest of the country, right? And that is a factor leading into the poverty rates in California, making it difficult for commercial operations, companies to operate because the higher cost of electricity and so on. So we know wind and solar and so-called renewables are highly inefficient, very low energy flux density, high variability, and an extremely costly source of electricity. Well, we want to look at that against the reality of the importance of energy and electricity in an economy. And I'm stating, what most people would see to be completely and totally obvious. any modern economy, any developed economy, developed nation, you need power. You need electricity. You need energy, right? And there's a very clear, direct relation between the amount of energy consumption your economy has, the energy flux density of your national economy as a whole, and pretty much any standard of quality of life that you can think of. Here we see a relation between 119 countries comparing their average electricity consumption per person and the rate of child mortality rate in those countries. And again, you see a very clear relation when you look at this scatter plot. Each dot there represents an individual country. And when you just take these two relations, electricity consumption per capita and child mortality rates, that's deaths of children under the age of five, right? What, how, of every 1,000 children under five, how many how many are dying of every 1,000 children existing in the economy under the age of five, how many are dying before they go past the age of five, right? And so if you take these two relations and you plot 120 nations according to this, you see a very, very clear relation, right? The lower energy consumption, the lower electricity consumption an individual nation has, the higher the child mortality rates are. And you could look at this again for anything, for life expectancy, right? Nations that have higher electricity consumption, higher energy consumption, higher life expectancy, infrastructure, hospitals, you know, pretty much any type of, and we did a study on this last year, pretty much any type of data available that gives you some indication of the quality of life, the level of development, always correlates with electricity consumption, energy consumption. Again, no big surprise, right? How are you going to run a modern economy without energy, right? How without electricity? I mean, it's pretty obvious, but, you know, just to state it. So you have this, so what does this mean? What's the point of this then? if you wanted to reduce the global population, if you wanted to lower living standards, lower resource consumption, and place the majority of the population in conditions that are easy to control and manipulate, what we're seeing around the man-made climate change scare would be the perfect policy to do that. Right. Whatever your opinions are on the science, whatever your opinions are on renewable energy, whatever your opinions are on climate change, the reality is energy is necessary. And we are in a very much energy starved planet. And even in the United States, we're facing a major energy problem. Costs are going up, supplies are going down. And if we actually want to reverse the kind of the whole globalization process that's left us dependent on global so-called supply lines and supply chains and actually begin manufacturing again, that would require a major increase in energy and electricity in the United States. The bottom line is that energy is a absolutely indispensable part to growth, to development, to sustaining societies and to progress. And what's being proposed under the climate change scare, all this propaganda you're seeing, we have 10 years left to act, we have 5 years left to act, it's a crisis, the planet's being destroyed, so on and so on. And what they're pushing under that scare story is we have to get rid of all this cheap and efficient fossil fuels. They're not promoting nuclear for the most part. And they're saying we have to go with these incredibly unreliable, low energy flux density, extremely costly, extremely inefficient sources of electricity, which would just lead to mass suffering and mass death throughout the planet, right? So again, if that was your goal, if you thought the population, the global population, the planet was overpopulated, if you thought people were consuming too much, if you thought we needed to lower living standards and lower the global population, then this would be the perfect program to do that. This would give you exactly your objectives. The so-called renewable energy program in the context of the global warming scare. So that, I'm sure many of our viewers are aware, that type of ideology, that type of view is not hypothetical, right? And that's what we're going to look at a little bit in some of the broader history of that philosophical or ideological outlook. And this is often associated with the name Malthusian, a Malthusian ideology named after Thomas Malthus, who was an economist for the British East India Company, for a time the leading expression of the leading force factor of the British Empire. And he expounded upon a view that the planet is becoming overpopulated. There's no way we can grow enough food to support the population. Population growth is always going to grow faster than technological progress and agriculture. And therefore, you're going to have to deal with the fact that we're going to need to reduce populations, control populations, and so on. Right? This was a view he expressed. But it wasn't just his view. It wasn't just some academic sitting in an ivory tower, you know, coming up with some theory about population growth and agricultural production output and comparing the two. This was a highly political ideology, and it was used to justify many of the horrors of the policies of the British Empire. And if we want to look at just some examples of that, the not just general discussions of concerns about overpopulation, but active genocidal actions by the British Empire causing mass death in regions they controlled. We can just simply look at a couple cases. Look at the case of the Irish and the so-called potato famine in the middle 1800s, right? This is a horrific period under British rule. You had a population of somewhere around almost 8.5 million people in just a few years go down to 6 million people. Roughly around two million of those people died from starvation and associated diseases and other effects due to the collapse going on under British rule. And another chunk fled the country, and many of them died in an attempt to get to other places, get to the Americas, get to the United States, and find a new place to live there. And if people aren't familiar with this history, under British rule, under the British direction, while you had this blight affecting the potato crops, the population of Ireland was continuing to produce more than enough food for their entire population. But they were being forced to export it to Great Britain, to the British Empire, for the British Empire's uses. And when the famine really took off, the potato crops were failing, the British actually sent in 50,000 troops to guard the transport of the foods that were grown by the Irish people, taken from the country, put on ships, and exported out of the country. And you can just imagine these horrific scenes of literally hundreds of thousands, millions of people starving, still working every day to, in their nation, producing all of this food, but under the British colonial policy, under the British policy that was still taken off for export. And you can see here they're exporting pork, oats, flour, cattle, eggs, sheep, butter. So there's a diversity of crops. Under the British policy, they were just told you can eat, you can grow potatoes on a small plot of land. That's what you're allowed to do. And that's all you can grow. And there were even explicit policies to stop the expansion of agricultural land, explicit policies blocking the ability to drain swamps, to develop associated infrastructure that would actually allow them to expand their agricultural land, produce more food, deal with this horrific situation. That was denied by explicit policy by the British, right? So 2 million out of 8 million people, you know, almost a quarter of the population wiped out under the British rule. I have some quotes here just to give you a sense of the kind of ideology view of the British in this situation. One of the individuals that was directly in charge of the famine relief program. So they, you know, the British created a program to address the famine issue in Ireland. He said the problem of Irish overpopulation being altogether beyond the power of man, the cure had been supplied by the direct stroke of an all-wise providence. Right? Think about that. They're producing and exporting more than enough food to feed their entire population. The British are insisting that that must continue under their economic agreements, under their free trade policies, and the landowners, would let these people die rather than let them have the food they themselves are growing. And the person in charge of Irish famine relief in the British Empire says this was beyond the control of man to address or change this issue. And by the end, he said, it is in my opinion that too much has been done for the people of Ireland. That they're claiming the British did too much to try and help these people. And a lot of this goes with the free trade ideology, Adam Smith ideology, which, you know, is a little bit much to get into as part of this discussion. But, you know, these arguments that nations, governments should not be intervening into these so-called free market processes, even if that's causing mass death throughout these populations. Another quote, a British historian who accompanied the Queen of England at the time, when she traveled for a short trip to visit Ireland in the context of this famine, this is what he had to say upon returning from that trip with the Queen. I am daunted by the human chimpanzees I saw along that 100 miles of horrible country. I don't believe they are our fault. To see white chimpanzees is dreadful. If they were black, one would not feel it so much. Right. So just giving you a sense of the mindset, the view of human life, the view of the ideological view of this elite class, what we might today call this globalist class, this imperial class, what I think more historically accurately would be described as this oligarchical class. This is their view of their fellow men and women on this planet. They view them as lesser classes, and they have no problems with wiping out large portions of them, right? This is history. This is British imperial history. This is what happened. Right. If you want to look at just another example, you have just horrific cases of what happened in India and the entire Indian subcontinent under British rule. This is a picture from 1877 from the peak of a great famine then. A little difficult to look at. But if you look at the history of famines in the Indian subcontinent before British rule, you take 700 years of history before British rule, you had 14 major famines. So roughly about 2 per century on average for these 700 years before British rule. Under British rule, under the British East India Company, for example, from 1765 to 1858, so not even 100 years, you had 16 major famines. Right? More in less than 100 years than in the entire 700 years prior. And a lot of it, you had similar policies, British coming in, insisting exports occur, insisting grain reserves, other reserves were not allowed to be kept, denying infrastructure development. I mean, there's a whole lot of history to this, but it was very much the same same type of policy, same type of outlook. After the British Colonial Office took over from the British East India Company, in what, a 55-year period, you had another 25 major famines, right? So about one every 2 years. And it's, I get from what I read, the census and population records are not great for some of these earlier periods. So it's rough to estimate the exact cost of life. But during the entirety of British rule over India from these famines, conservative estimates based on official British figures puts it in the range of 60 million people, right? Wiped out under their policy. And what did they think about it? What were their views? Well, Winston Churchill was involved in some of this. Here's one quote from a book describing some of his actions. In particular, ensuring that food would still be exported from India, brought into the United Kingdom. Churchill explaining why he defended the stockpiling of food within Britain while millions died of starvation in Bengal. He told his private secretary, quote, "The Hindus were a foul race, protected by their mere pollution from the doom that is their due." Right? So again, nice British oligarchical imperial mindset outlook reflected very clearly. And this was early 1940s. In this case. So this is some of the actual, you know, just some snippets, some slices of the horrors of British imperial policy, right? We didn't even touch on, I mean, there's a lot more, their entire activity in Africa, you could go on, right? I mean, this is extensive. But this is the reality of the political forces, the economic forces, the globalist oligarchical forces, that following World War II were the people that created the modern environmentalist movement. So coming out of World War II, you had the emergence of this big environmentalist push. It was not just an organic movement. It was a top-down program. And here we have some of the key figures depicted who really got this thing going. You had Sir Julian Huxley. He was a leading eugenicist in Great Britain. He was a major proponent of eugenics prior to World War II, and even after World War II, when the horrors of what Hitler had done, the horrific genocide and the eugenics program of the Nazis, when that was exposed, when that was known, Julian Huxley continued to promote eugenics, arguing for it in the founding document of UNESCO, of which he was the first director, the first head, right? You have Prince Philip, the consort to the queen that unfortunately is still hanging around even today. Somebody who advocated multiple times on record that if he could be reincarnated, he would like to come back as a deadly virus to address the problem of overpopulation, right? To give you a sense of his views. A lot of Nazi connections in his history and his family. And then you have Prince Bernard of the Netherlands. So across over into Europe there. He was a very, very likely a member of Nazi intelligence, Nazi SS, highly connected to Nazis before the war and during the war. He was the head of an airline that played a key role in flying leading Nazis out of Germany and out of Europe as the war was concluding. And under his jurisdiction, that KLM airline stopped recording passengers for a period of time, when all these Nazis were being flown out to safety, right? So who are these figures? Huxley, Prince Philip, Prince Bernard. Well, these are the people that started the World Wildlife Fund. These are the people that started a lot of the core institutions that bankrolled and funded the development of this modern environmentalist movement. And they used this new banner of environmentalism, of conservation, of promoting these concerns about overpopulation, promoting these concerns about damaging the environment, to argue for the exact same imperial policies that these oligarchs have been arguing for centuries before, right? Deny countries and populations the right to utilize their resources. Don't let them develop infrastructure. Don't let them develop and expand their populations, right? Same policies, same oligarchical policies that you saw in Ireland, that you saw in India, that you saw in Africa. Now they're just doing it under the banner, under the name of environmentalism, right? Eugenicists, Nazis, literally coming together, forming the modern environmentalist movement, right? So this is the, you know, important history leading into what we're dealing with now. Now, in terms of the climate change issue specifically, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of aspects of the history to it, but one particular conference stands out in 1975, which kind of started to put the global warming issue on the agenda. So this was a conference called The Atmosphere, Endangered and Endangering. And according to the report, the main purpose of this conference is to anticipate the call that will be made on scientists and leaders of government regarding the need to protect the atmospheric environment before these calls are made. So they were saying that they knew there was going to be some push to begin to protect the atmosphere, so-called. And this conference was to bring people together to prepare themselves for that occurring. And some of the participants in this conference, Margaret Mead was a leading participant. John Holdren was there. You might be familiar with him. He was Obama's scientific advisor. And a couple other figures we'll see in a second. So just to get a sense of what this conference was like and what was discussed at this conference, here's Margaret Mead's keynote. Here's a couple excerpts. So she starts off, "At this conference, we are proposing that before there is a corresponding attempt to develop a law of the air, the scientific community advised the United Nations and individual powerful nation states or aggregates of weaker nation states, an attempt to arrive at some overview of what is presently known about hazards to the atmosphere from man-made interventions and how scientific knowledge coupled with intelligent social action can protect the peoples of the world from dangerous and preventable interference with the atmosphere upon which all life depends." So that doesn't sound too bad, I guess, right? Pretty straightforward. A little later in her keynote, she lets the cat out of the bag, though. She really says what they were doing there. She says, "What we need from scientists are estimates presented with sufficient conservatism and plausibility, but at the same time, as free as possible from internal disagreements that can be exploited by political interests. That will allow us to start building a system of artificial but effective warnings, warnings which will parallel the instincts of animals who flee before the hurricane." So I'm going to read that again. This is her keynote. This is her addressing the entire conference. She's giving the keynote address, the main address of the entire conference. And she's telling all these people gathered why they're there and what they need to do at this conference. She says, "What we need from scientists are estimates presented with sufficient conservatism and plausibility, but at the same time, as free as possible from internal disagreements that can be exploited by political interests. That will allow us to start building a system of artificial but effective warnings, which will parallel the instincts of animals who flee before the hurricane." So to me, I read that and I say, she's saying we need to develop propaganda we all agree upon that will terrify the population into going along with a policy in the same way that an animal sees a coming hurricane or storm and reacts out of fear and emotional response in being presented with that threat, Right. She's saying we need to present plausible arguments free of any disagreements or you know, questions we have. Present propaganda based on that in that form to the general population to induce a kind of emotional response in the population as the population were a bunch of animals fleeing from some danger, right? So again, 1975, leading conference on the issue of the atmosphere, the endangered atmosphere, with a number of figures, Margaret Mead, as we mentioned, John Holdren, as we mentioned, also Stephen Schneider, who was a major advocate of the global warming scare in the 80s when this really started getting going. He was at this conference, major figure in pushing the whole man-made climate change issue. He had a rather interesting thing to say in a 1989 article in Discover Magazine, which I think reflects what Margaret Mead said and reflects what we've been hearing so far in terms of how they're using the climate change scare. He says, pretty revealing, on the one hand, as scientists, we are ethically bound to the scientific method, in effect, promising to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but. Make sense? This is what science is, right? And then he goes on, but on the other hand, we are not just scientists, but human beings as well. We need to get some broad-based support to capture the public's imagination. That, of course, entails getting loads of media coverage. So we have to offer up scary scenarios, make simplified, dramatic statements, and make little mention of any doubts we might have. This double ethical bind we frequently find ourselves in cannot be solved by any formula. Each of us has to decide what the right balance is between being effective and being honest. So it sounds like Stephen Schneider, as a participant in this 1975 conference, took Margaret Mead's keynote to heart in his views on how to push their agenda, push their views on the population. So what do we get out of this? You know, this is supposedly the science. These are supposedly the scientists, right? We're told, follow the science, believe the science, don't deny the science. Here we have the people that are supposedly presenting us the science, doing the science, coming up with the conclusions, openly saying that they need to not be afraid of offering up scary scenarios, simplifying things, making dramatic statements, and not stating their doubts, not stating concerns they have that maybe the conclusions they're presenting aren't fully accurate, right? So this is the supposed science. And what has this led to? What do we get out of the supposed climate change, global warming science? I mean, a lot could be said here. I just want to highlight some particular examples of how what, you know, I would say what were presented as science has been fraudulent or close to fraudulent. People might be familiar with the hockey stick curve. This was from a number of years ago, but I think is very relevant. Again, you see the consistent thread here between what Margaret Mead laid out, what people like Schneider said, and then what we actually get. So the hockey stick, if you're not familiar with it, was this famous case where you had a representation of historical climate records, which made things look a lot worse. And what you have here shown is that various representations of the global climate average temperature going back 1,000 years. At the top, you have a report from the IPCC itself in 1990. And as you see there, if you can see, it might be a little bit small, depending on what screen you're looking at. But the point is there's significant variation in the climate over the past 1,000 years. It got significantly colder. in the 1600s, 1700s, 1500s. Before that, in the 1100s, 1200s, 1300s, you had what they called the medieval warm period, where the global average temperature was significantly higher than it was in the 1600s, right? So you have a significant amount of natural variability in the climate. The climate changes. Climate change is real. We're just not the ones causing it. So at the top, you see the IPCC itself reflecting this reality, recognizing this reality. In the lower graphs, you see the same historical period shown with other studies, other data showing a similar trend. Significant variability, significant change in the climate naturally, right? No one's saying, these people aren't saying human activity caused the medieval warm period, right? That happened. It was must have been a natural variation in the climate, right? But then starting around 2000, 2001, a new study came out, which all of a sudden went against all of these previous records and said, actually, the climate of the last 1,000 years has been really steady. It hasn't changed much at all. It's been really even. And it's only in the past 100 years that we see this big increase in temperature. So what does that mean? It must be human activity, because before us, before the Industrial Revolution and burning of fossil fuels in large amounts, look how even and steady the climate was. It didn't change that much. And then all of a sudden it takes off and it shoots up. And therefore this is the proof, the demonstration that human activity is causing a change, a deviation from the natural state of the climate, and so on and so on. And you see it in the top panel there as it was depicted in the 2001 IPCC report. The actual data from the study itself under hockey stick in panel D there. And then Al Gore used this, promoted it significantly in his propaganda efforts in the 2000s. But it came out, this is a completely ridiculous study. You got this hockey stick shape, which is like a, you know, a flat trend line, and all of a sudden it shoots up towards the very end, like a hockey stick turned on its side, right? Was purely based on the statistical methods they used to analyze the data. And this was proven. This was demonstrated in published literature. They showed that you could take any, they literally took random data sets, dozens of random data sets, put them through the same kind of statistical analysis that they used to produce this hockey stick climate chart, and they got the same effect. No matter what data you used, the type of statistical analysis they used would even out all the past data, and the more recent data would shoot upwards. It was an artifact of the process they used to analyze and combine the data. So this was demonstrated to be a total fraud. And then you have a whole history of so-called adjustments, changing what the historical records had been of what the climate was. So here we're looking at just from NOAA and NASA, what they told us. If you were to go to the NOAA NASA website, read about the history of the temperature in the United States in 1999, this is what graph they would have shown you. And I've added on there, you can see there's about a sixth of a degree difference between the peak temperature in 1998 and the peak temperature in the mid-1930s. And the mid-1930s was warmer than the late 1990s, according to NASA, NOAA, in 1999. Then they went back and they said, "Oh, we have to adjust this data. The way we measured the temperature in the past and the way we combined the different measuring stations, it just doesn't quite work, and we need to redo it." And then in 2006, you get this graph, when all of a sudden the 90s were now hotter than the 30s, when that wasn't the case before, right? And some people have gone back and looked at how they've done this, and they've shown that consistently when they do these adjustments, this isn't a graphic of actual temperature variation. This is a graphic of how much they've changed the temperature records in different years. So this is US historical temperature records. And what you see with the red or the blue is depicting how much of an adjustment was made to the temperature record if you look at what they gave you in 2008 versus 2015. And what do you see? They're systematically cooling all the past records. They're saying 1880, 1890, 1900, 1910, 1930s. We actually have to make these cooler. What we had on record didn't seem right. We have to change the record, change what we're presenting as the measurements. And we're going to say that actually the temperature was cooler back then. We're adjusting what we had said prior. And all the more recent periods, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, they're adjusting all those upwards. They're saying that's warmer. So you just get an overall adjustment of the entire record to make it look like the past was cooler and the most recent period was warmer through these supposed adjustments, right? Now, this is just, again, one study, but think about this in the context of everything we've looked at, right? Going back to, statements by this guy, Schneider, what we saw with the hockey stick curve, back to the Margaret Mead conference, and really back to the ideology, the oligarchical Malthusian ideology that we've been fighting against, really for the entirety of modern human history, if you really want to get into it. And there's been other adjustments. This was another one they did in 2015. I'm not going to go through all the details of that. I think we've covered that enough. So coming back to where we are now, just to bring it around and get into the Q&A, we're going into another one of these crazy climate conferences. We got COP26 coming up. Definitely makes sense. It's on Halloween, right? Couldn't have planned that better, right? And all these people are coming out. Susan highlighted Prince Charles, right? What he's saying, we only got 10 years left. He's been saying that, every 10 years for decades now, right? And we only got so many years left. We have to act, right? Prince Charles, British royal family figure, right? British establishment, right? You couldn't get more oligarchical than the British royal family, right? Who else do we have coming out? The Queen herself, right? Poor lady says she's irritated. It's irritating the lack of action on climate change. And she's done this a number of times, right? She's come out really, which technically should be outside of her role to intervene in politics and these kinds of affairs. But she's come out rather forcefully arguing for action on these climate issues. So when it comes back around, you have these same continuity of this oligarchical faction. They're the ones rallying behind this policy. A lot of other people are getting, swept up in the propaganda, and they, they believe the stuff that they're being presented, and they're unfortunately getting duped. But at the higher levels, this is 100% through and through, completely consistent with a full Malthusian policy for global population reduction, mass death, mass suffering, lowering consumption, lowering the population, right? Again, as I said in the beginning, if that was your goal, if you were a Malthusian, right? Like we looked at with these British horrors of genocide in Ireland, in India, in Africa, right? If that was your outlook, and you're looking at the world today, and you were to say, how can we rein in the power of these sovereign nations? How can we reduce their economic strength, their economic independence? How can we lower the population? How can we reduce how much consumption is going on of the resources that we would like to control, that we would like to manage? How do we bring the global population to a level that's more manageable? Well, you probably couldn't find a better policy than wind, solar, eliminating all fossil fuels, and going with this green agenda, green program, all under the scare of this, supposed man-made climate change catastrophe coming at us. So that's what I got for the discussion today. We got some more planned next week to go into a little bit more of some of the science, what's really happening with the climate. Probably going to touch on some of the frauds of the models that these guys are using to make up these scare stories. But we thought today it would be good to give this kind of broader historical context. So you're not just looking at this as some conference in and of itself, but you see it in the actual historical reality of the fight against oligarchy and empire and the British Empire that we've been dealing with. So hopefully that's provocative. Hopefully we got some good discussion.